Oh, happy Sunday, everybody. Oh, good to see you all. Well, Harriet, all kinds of people are here today. Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. I'm just going to have a look at the other screen. Oh, okay, great. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming out, at least in the Vancouver, rather rainy Sunday morning. Last week, we held a memorial service for Thich Nhat Hanh. And today I thought I'd like to talk a little bit about the life and teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, or Thay, as he was affectionately called by his followers, friends, and people who just fell deeply in love with his teachings. I think perhaps everyone knows that he died, I guess over a week ago now, at the age of 95, after a long life of practicing and teaching the Dharma. He was one of those rare teachers who not only offered the Dharma to his students, but to the world. Just over a week ago, at our Saturday workshop with Dzogchen Norman Fisher, Norman said that the two most prominent and influential Buddhist teachers over the past 50 years were the Dalai Lama, or are the Dalai Lama, and Thich Nhat Hanh. And that's hard to argue with. Norman also went on to tell us a story of his own relationship or connection with Thich Nhat Hanh. In the earlier years at San Francisco Zen Center, Thich Nhat Hanh would come on occasion to lead retreats, give talks. He was very supportive when the kind of leadership crisis happened at Green Gulch. He counseled and gave advice to many of the senior students when Richard Baker was asked to step down. But Norman told a personal story, and that was when he was given transmission. In other words, when he was fully encouraged to speak and given permission to do Dokusan, give Dharma talks, etc. He felt that he wasn't enlightened. And he had read something in Thich Nhat Hanh's writings that a person, you should always find a true teacher. So Norman felt he wasn't really a true teacher. And at some point, he met with Thich Nhat Hanh and asked him about this dilemma that he felt he was in. And Thich Nhat Hanh responded something like, "Oh, please don't worry. The people who were here 2 weeks ago will help the people who just arrived. And the people who were here 6 months ago will help the people who were here for 2 weeks." That it is warm hand to warm hand. Whatever we have learned, we can offer to somebody else who has not yet learned that. Whatever we have seen, we can offer to some person who has not yet seen that. So Norman found that very encouraging, and thus began his long career of teaching, which I am very deeply grateful for. So I dug around a little bit on the internet and learned that Thich Nhat Hanh had published over 100 books in English. Over 100 books in English. And I was looking at our own bookshelf here at home. And Kate and I have at least about a dozen of Thich Nhat Hanh's books on our bookshelves. Mostly his commentaries on classical Buddhist texts, Buddhist psychology, and philosophy. But Thay also published books on meditation practice, children's stories, poetry, engaged Buddhism, working with challenging emotions like fear and anger, relationships, ethics, ecology. when I was looking at this list on Amazon, I thought the only thing he hasn't published is a cookbook. But he seemed he'd covered almost every other aspect of human life. The breadth of his creativity is amazing. And so is his skill at bringing challenging Buddhist concepts to life, helping his readers to apply them in everyday situations over and over again. He was also an artist, as well, of course, as a teacher, a curator and leader of communities, a dedicated peace activist, and a Buddhist monk. It is, I know, impossible to honor the fullness of his life in the short time that we have this morning. But let's look at some of the teachings that he left us and the support that he continues to give us through particularly his writings, but also his Dharma talks that are easily accessible online. So, Thich Nhat Hanh was born in Vietnam in 1926, and he became a novice in the Vietnamese Zen tradition around the age of 16. And apparently, he had always wanted to be a monk, even when he was a young child. And I think it's important to note that for most of his early life, Vietnam was occupied. It was occupied by a colonial powers. First by the French, who treated Vietnam terribly, just like other colonial powers treated their colonies. So first by the French, then by the Japanese, who occupied Vietnam in 1940 to 45. And then there was the first Indochina War, which followed immediately between the French colonial power and immediately after the Japanese left, between the French colonial power, which wanted to come back, and the Vietnam, the nationalist movement at that time that wanted a free Vietnam. If you haven't read anything about the history of Vietnam, it's very tragic. Also, has a very beautiful history and culture, but often they were colonized early on by the Chinese, and then, of course, before they were a country, but the French moved in, etc. So at any rate, as a young man, Thay was active in the movement to revitalize, in some ways, modernize the Vietnamese Zen tradition. And he worked hard to do that, including study. In 1961, he received a scholarship to study comparative religion at Princeton Theological Seminary. And the following year, he went on to study and research Vietnamese Buddhism at Columbia University. So he had a very strong academic bent as well. And that was a very important time in his life. In his published journal called Fragrant Palm Leaves, we read of Thich Nhat Hanh now in his mid-30s, as he was writing, affirming his Buddhist insights and his role in trying to reform Vietnamese Buddhism as an agent for peace in his war-torn country. He writes very beautifully and poignantly there of his own personal struggle with his life and his understanding of the forces that shape us. So I'm going to read a couple of quotes from that journal. He writes, "Our joys and sorrows, likes and dislikes, are colored by our environment so much that often we just let our surroundings dictate our course. We go along with public feelings until we no longer even know our own true aspirations. We become a stranger to ourselves, molded entirely by society. Sometimes I feel caught between two opposing selves, the false self imposed by society and what I would call my true self. How often we confuse the two and assume society's mold to be our true self. Battles between our two selves rarely result in a peaceful reconciliation. Our mind becomes a battlefield on which the five aggregates, form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness of our being, are strewn about like debris in a hurricane. Trees topple, branches snap, houses crash. So throughout, particularly this chapter, but throughout his journal, Thich Nhat Hanh questions the purpose and role of the self that is imposed by society and by our conditioning. He questioned the common assumption that this imposed self is our true self. Sometimes we must, of course, all question if we're to discover and fully live what Thay calls our true self. He goes on to describe the struggle waged inside as we each challenge the imposed self as a kind of great battle or hurricane. And no wonder a great battle, because he'd grown up basically in constant struggle and war going on in his country. Nevertheless, I think we can relate to that experience, right? The life that we're told we should have versus the life that calls from inside of us. A little bit further on in the same book, Fragrant Palm Leaves, he continues, "These are our loneliest moments, these times that we struggle. These are our loneliest moments. Yet every time we survive such a storm, we grow a little. Without storms like these, I would not be who I am today. But I rarely hear such a storm coming until it's already upon me. It seems to appear without warning, as though treading silently on silk slippers." So this struggle to actualize our true self, maybe we say to actualize our Buddha nature, to use a term that we often use, are our loneliest moments, Thay writes. These are the times, perhaps, that we are caught in delusion after delusion, story after story, maybe seeing no way forward, but distraught over the limited and very unsatisfying life that we're living. But he points out, Thay points out, that every time we survive such a storm of self-doubt or confusion, when we look deeper than the limited and unsatisfying life, we grow a little, just as he did. Staying steady in one particular storm, perhaps Thay was just allowing his body to be still, following his breath, Thay had an insight. He writes, "I had always thought of myself as a solid entity, and suddenly I saw I am not solid at all. I saw that the entity I had always taken myself was really a fabrication. My true nature, I realized, was much more real, both uglier and more beautiful than I could ever have imagined." When I read this, I was very grateful for Thay's courage and honesty in his description of his true nature, being both uglier and more beautiful than he could imagine. So strange, right? To hear the true nature described as both ugly and beautiful. And I wondered what he meant by this passage. Maybe it was something along the line that an experience of true nature goes beyond whatever we expect. A bit later, in the same book, we see the deeply human qualities of Thay and the role of deep questioning in his own practice. He writes, "My friends know I can be as playful and mischievous as a child. I love to kid around and enter fully into the game of life. I also know what it is to get angry. And I know the pleasure of being praised. I am often on the verge of tears or laughter. But beneath all of these emotions, what else is there? How can I touch it? If there isn't anything, why would I be so certain that there is?" Now, isn't this the koan, the deep question of every life? What is underneath this? It really is, I think, the Genjo koan of Dogen that we're studying on Wednesday nights. It is the fundamental koan of our life, expressed in his beautiful, simple, poetic way. Beneath all our thoughts and feelings, what is there? What is this everyday self that I try so hard to protect and believe in so strongly? In another passage, again a little further on, Thay brings forward the image of death, not as a bleak end, but as transformation of life's most intractable struggles. He writes, "Some life dilemmas cannot be solved by study or rational thought. We just live with them, struggle with them, become one with them. To live, we must die every instant. We must perish again and again in the storms that make life possible. We must perish again and again in the storms that make life possible." So here I think Thay tells us that we cannot always think our way out of our delusions, but we must meet those delusions, hold them about ourselves, and let them go. Let the self delusion, the false self, as Thay calls it, die over and over again as we face the challenges of life. Now, these early experiences that Thay had, and all of this is written while he was in America, the years that he was both at Princeton and Columbia, these experiences shaped Thay's thoughts and views of Buddhist tradition around interbeing and engaged Buddhism, those two became the cornerstones of his teachings and practices for the rest of his life. So let's look at those. In his book called The Heart of Understanding, Commentaries on the Prajnaparamita Sutta, which is the Heart Sutra that we chant, he offered this explanation about interbeing, which is, of course, a phrase that he coined. He writes in this little book, if you are a poet, you will see clearly that there is a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, trees cannot grow. Without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. So we can say that the cloud and paper inter are. Interbeing is a word that is not in the dictionary yet, but if we combine the prefix inter with the verb to be, we have a new verb, interbe. Without a cloud, we cannot have paper. And so we can say that the cloud and the sheet of paper inter are. So a little bit later, he also then continues to make this understanding of interbeing very personal and very direct. He writes, looking even more closely, we can see we are in it too. This is not difficult to see, because when we look at a sheet of paper, the sheet of paper is part of our perception. Your mind is in here, and mine is also. So we can say that everything is in here with this sheet of paper. You cannot point out anything that is not here. Time, space, the earth, the rain, the minerals and the soil, the sunshine, the cloud, the river, the heat, everything. Everything coexists with this sheet of paper. That is why I think the word interbe should be in the dictionary. To be is to interbe. You cannot just be by yourself alone. You have to interbe with every other thing. This sheet of paper is because everything else is. So using this interbeing, the word that he coined, he skillfully, I think, illustrates the boundlessness of all things, the intimacy of all things. And he does this by avoiding all of those abstract Buddhist terms. Thay's writing is characterized by clarity, simple language and metaphor, as he addresses some of the most fundamental and complex teachings in the Buddhist tradition. For example, in the same book, he presents the Buddhist word shunyata, emptiness, by first warning his readers not to hold too tightly to their own views. And I find this passage quite fascinating. He writes, understanding is like water flowing in a stream. Wisdom and knowledge are solid and can block our understanding. In Buddhism, knowledge is regarded as an obstacle for understanding. If we take something to be the truth, we may cling to it so much that even if the truth comes forward and knocks on our door, we won't want to let it in. We have to be able to transcend our previous knowledge the way we climb up a ladder. We must learn to transcend our own views. Understanding, like water, can flow, can penetrate. Views, knowledge, and even wisdom can seem solid and fixed, and can block the way of understanding. Isn't that beautiful? Understanding is like water flowing in a stream. So then, having kind of massaged our, softened hopefully, our views a little, Thay then goes on with a simple analogy to explain the emptiness of self. He writes, in our bodies we have lungs, heart, kidneys, stomach, and blood. None of these can exist independently. They can only coexist with the others. Your lungs and your blood are two things, but neither can exist separately. The lungs take in the air and enrich the blood, and in turn, the blood nourishes the lungs. Without the blood, the lungs cannot be alive, and without the lungs, the blood cannot be cleansed and rejuvenated. Lungs and blood inter are. When Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, says that our sheet of paper is empty, they mean it is empty of a separate, independent existence. It cannot just be by itself. It has to interbe with the sunshine, the cloud, the forest, the logger, the mind, and everything else. It is empty of a separate self. But empty of a separate self means full of everything. Now, this emphasis on interbeing we find all throughout Thay's writings. He returns to it again and again, interbeing, and connected to that, the emptiness of separate self. So I picked up another book on love, a book called How to Love. Pretty good title, eh? How to Love. And he writes this in that book, emphasizing again the interconnectedness or the interbeing of all things. So this is all for you lovers out there, since we're coming up to Valentine's Day before too long. He says, often when we say, I love you, we focus mostly on the idea of I, who is doing the loving, and less on the quality of the love that is being offered. This is because we're caught by the idea of self. We think we have a self, but there is no such thing as an individual separate self. A flower is made of only non-flower elements, such as chlorophyll, sunlight, and water. If we were to move all the non-flower elements from the flower, there would be no flower left. A flower can only interbe with all of us. Humans are like this too. We cannot exist by ourselves alone. We can only interbe. I am made only of non-me elements, such as the earth, sunshine, parents, ancestors. In a relationship, if you can see the nature of interbeing between you and the other person, you can see that their suffering is your suffering. Your happiness is their own happiness. With this way of seeing, you speak and act differently. This in itself can relieve so much suffering. He then goes on, talking about love, by emphasizing understanding. Remember, we learned that understanding is like flowing water, right? Rather than knowing, which he's saying is kind of like a block or something solid. Understanding is like flowing water in a stream. So, connected to love, he writes, to love without knowing how to love wounds the person we love. To love without knowing how to love wounds the person we love. To know how to love someone, we have to understand. We have to understand them. To understand, we need to listen. The more you understand, the more you love. The more you love, the more you understand. They are two sides of one reality. The mind of love and the mind of understanding are the same. Interbeing. Well, I think out of that same core of interbeing came Thay's engagement with public life. To teach both lay and ordained, and also his profound commitment to social ills. He was strongly opposed to the Vietnam War and started a nonviolent resistance movement called the Small Peace Corps to rebuild homes, schools, and hospitals that the American bombing and also bombing by the North had destroyed. He encouraged his fellow monks and nuns when he was back in Vietnam to engage in rebuilding and easing the suffering of others in any way possible. In yet another book, a book called Love in Action, Writings on Nonviolent Social Change, he wrote this. The essence of nonviolence is love. Out of love and the willingness to act selflessly, strategies, tactics, and techniques for a nonviolent struggle arise naturally. Other struggles may be fueled by greed, hatred, fear or ignorance, but a nonviolent one cannot use such blind sources of energy, for they will destroy those involved and also the struggle itself. Nonviolent action, born of the awareness of suffering and nurtured by love, is the most effective way to confront adversity. I think you can see in this passage, and certainly when you read the rest of the book, how deeply influenced he was by the people who came before him, who taught the same kind of message, like Gandhi. He was also, of course, acquainted with and friends with Martin Luther King, who had nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work to try end the war in Vietnam. So Thay called on those who call themselves Buddhists of any kind, and also Christians, to participate in nonviolent action to ease the great sufferings that he saw all around the world. And he coined the term engaged Buddhism to label this movement of Buddhism that was for everybody. In an interview, he said this. When I was a novice in Vietnam, we young monks witnessed the suffering caused by the war. So we were very eager to practice Buddhism in such a way that we could bring it to society. That was not easy, because the tradition does not directly offer engaged Buddhism. So we had to do it ourselves. That was the birth of engaged Buddhism. Engaged Buddhism is just Buddhism. When bombs begin to fall on people, you cannot stay in the meditation hall all the time. Meditation is about the awareness of what is going on, not only in your body and in your feelings, but all around you. Because of his work in Vietnam and his promotion of engaged Buddhism, selflessly helping both sides, anyone who needed help, he was exiled from Vietnam and spent the rest of his life until very near the end in exile, building communities. Plum Village in France is, of course, the kind of his home, or was his home. Deer Park in California, other places. He supported many communities to practice the Vietnamese Zen tradition. But towards the end of his life, he was allowed to go back. There was a great return that he's welcome back. And then when he suffered his severe stroke, he was allowed to go back to his home temple. And that is where he spent the last months of his life. But I thought I'd like to end on a little more positive note than just the end of Thich Nhat Hanh's life. As I mentioned at the beginning, he was also an artist. And in that same simple way that he expressed the Dharma, he used art to express the Dharma as well. So I'm just going to show you using the screen share here. A few slides. Okay. Can everyone see this okay? Just give me a thumb to show me. Good, thank you. So this is typical kind of calligraphy that Thich Nhat Hanh did. And he had a very interesting way of doing calligraphy. And I should say, in the Vietnamese tradition, they also have a form of calligraphy that uses the Roman alphabet, as well as the Chinese characters. And so if you go online, you can see what that looks like. It's very ornate looking. You can get a little bit of a sense by how he does his U's, for example, and G's when you look at the Vietnamese style. It's written in Vietnamese, but using the Roman alphabet. Quite interesting. Anyway, when Thich Nhat Hanh sat down to grind his ink, he would pour some of his tea into the stone that he would grind his ink and mix it. I also read that when he does his ensos, these circles that go around, he would kind of breathe in for the first half and then kind of breathe out for the second half. And I noticed all his ensos are very circular, and they usually meet. They come to kind of a meeting place. So he really does make a circle. But I love the way he writes his words in the middle. So you can see his style is very free, but also quite simple. Here's something a little different. I couldn't find too much, but here we have the Heart Sutra that he begins to write, again using a brush. Some of the brushes he used were traditional Chinese or Japanese brushes, and some brushes were very modern, kind of like a fountain pen, right? They had the ink stored in the main part of the pen and then a brush at the end. I saw videos of him painting or making calligraphy with those as well. The famous one, breathe. Quite strong. And most of them are written on rice paper, the traditional Chinese and Japanese forms of paper. And I think that's the last one. Listen with compassion. He wrote, in my calligraphy, there is ink, tea, breathing, mindfulness, and concentration. So I was thinking, maybe one way we can honor Thich Nhat Hanh, if you would like a practice to do, is to do your own calligraphy, like Thich Nhat Hanh did. Using a brush or a pen, you can copy something out, or just a simple phrase. Post it on your fridge. Post it on your bathroom mirror. Give it away to a friend. I think this would be a wonderful way to remember this great teacher who taught with such clarity. Such clarity and compassion. So this is the practice in Japanese called Shakyo, copying out sutras. And traditionally Heart Sutra, Diamond Sutra, sometimes Lotus Sutra, these are all called copied by hand. But you can copy anything and give it away. Share it with somebody. I think I've talked long enough, so I'll stop here.